This is Scott Becker with the Becker's Healthcare Podcast. I'm thrilled today to be joined by sort of a brilliant healthcare attorney who's also worked at CMS. I'm going to ask Tim Fry, who's with McGuire Woods, really three or four questions. What should providers be doing now? What are three to four things he's learned from working with private equity funds and invest in healthcare providers? And what was it like working with CMS when he used to work there? Tim, take a moment and introduce yourself, and then we'll start with the core of the podcast.
Thank you so much, Scott. It's a pleasure to join you today. As you said, I'm an attorney with the McGuire Woods Healthcare Group. I'm a former lobbyist for the National Rural Health Association, and then was a staffer for CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, in their Office of Legislation in DC. And from that background, I've really focused my career on responding to the healthcare regulatory environment and reimbursement policy, Stark Law. Right now, all things are COVID-19 related, but generally try to support healthcare transactions, regulatory needs for our clients, both physician-owned and private equity-backed platforms. And one other thing I'll just note, Scott, is right now I'm also a first grade math teacher and a professional party planner remotely from the western suburbs of Chicago. So during this time, it's obviously challenging us all and stretching us, and that's creeping into our family life as well.
No, and I could imagine. Let me ask you three things providers should be doing now. And I do at some point want to touch on rural healthcare, because that will be incredibly challenged post this and during this. But take a moment to tell us three things providers should be doing currently.
Yes, Scott. And I'll give you kind of highlights, and then we can dig in if you'd like to on any of them. You know, one thing providers have really been challenged over the last couple months is they've shut their practices down, in some cases overnight, with elective procedures, or in the hospital context, switching to a different type of patient. And really something that I think is now getting forgotten about in the excitement of potentially reopening and reshifting is just being sure that there is a plan in place if reclosing has to happen, or if your staff gets infected by COVID-19, or your patients don't come back to the office as quickly. And so we're seeing and talking to clients now in that kind of excitement and push to reopen that they need to just at least have in their back of their mind, what would happen if we had a second wave? What would happen if the economy kind of double dips? All things to be considering and thinking about in different ways. Part of that, and also kind of the excitement of reopening, I'd say providers, like, you know, all businesses, really need to be doubled down on their relationships. The relationships with their staffs, who may be going through kind of the worst time of their lives, doing things that they never planned to do. You can burn through a lot of staff goodwill if you're not kind of building on that relationship. Patients, the same thing. Patients are to come back to the office. They may have a lot of questions about how, you know, their pre-existing conditions might interact with COVID-19. They might be concerned that they're not getting the right drugs or other healthcare needs right now. And kind of building those relationships kind of through this worst time is something I think everybody needs to be thinking about. And then the last thing I just add, Scott, kind of third, the world is changing every day. You just need to be thinking about it. You need to be working with law firms, your professional associations, and monitoring things like the PPP program that the Small Business Administration has put out, or the relief funds, or CMS is putting waivers almost on a daily basis. It's just a glut of changes. And I think people, you know, are trying to do their best to monitor it. But I think people also need to, kind of doubling back to the relationship piece, be transparent. Tell your staff why this is such a difficult time and what you're dealing with. Tell your patients why changes to their care may be necessary and may need to change on a daily basis. And you kind of have to do all those things at the same time, which I know so many of the healthcare community are at this time.
So Tim, three great pieces of advice. Make some sort of contingency plan if you have to go backwards to shut down again or partially shut down. Second, double down on your relationships, whether it's your patients, your employees, your other people you do business with, and so forth. And three, do everything you can to keep a close eye on changes that can impact practice, like regulatory changes, CMS issues, all kinds of other issues. I think you've hit that right on, and great advice. Let me ask you another question. You do a lot of work with mega and mid-size private equity funds that invest in healthcare. What are three or four of the things that you're seeing related to them right now and how this is working? Because some of those have a model of business that's built on investing and then selling over a few years, a model of investment that's built on investing, but borrowing a lot of money behind the investment to try and leverage the investment. What are three of the four things that you're seeing currently?
Yeah, that's well stated, Scott. And I think everybody is trying to kind of figure this out in the new normal as we go. I think, you know, a couple key changes we're seeing in the private equity space in response to COVID-19, kind of coming off of the things you mentioned. One, for deals, it's really hard to figure out what the appropriate value, purchase price, economic deal should be. Are we going to return to business as usual such that you could take, you know, 2019 revenue and use that as a basis of purchase price? Or, you know, do we need to kind of expect a slow reopening? And I think everyone is kind of making their own determinations there and making their own bets. Second, you're absolutely right. Most of the private equity transactions have some debt component, some leverage from lenders. And that relationship for private equity funds, going back to the relationship piece, is just so critical to over communicate, explain your plans, explain how the kind of debt will be used, and how the overall business is doing, such that the lender has comfort to kind of continue with the deals that you have in your pipeline. And then quite honestly, three, Scott, is a lot of funds are seeing this as potentially a great opportunity to find new and different partners. So we have a number of fund clients and their providers that they back who have stayed in touch with potential transaction targets and have shared business strategy or shared regulatory guidance, or they've shared kind of, here's how we're thinking about COVID-19. What things can we do together? We haven't acquired you yet. Maybe you're not ready for that, but you're a smaller practice. You don't have the resources we do. Can we kind of build a relationship, show you how we would work together during what for many healthcare practices, especially when they have so many elective procedures, is a very difficult time. So those are a couple ways we're seeing funds kind of try to respond to this crisis and think about the long term.
Thank you very much, Tim. You also worked for a period of time at CMS, and CMS has this very nuanced reputation. A lot of people have great respect for it. Some don't like it. Some think it's too bureaucratic. Some think other things. But this really fascinating perspective on it, and it obviously overall does a magnificent job. Give us a couple thoughts and perspectives of what it was like working with CMS and some of your thoughts.
Yeah, thanks, Scott. I have the utmost respect for the agency and the staff that works there. Really great colleagues, very smart, very dedicated to the beneficiaries across the country receiving care. And quite frankly, and I think, you know, quite honestly, the current administrator has, you know, put this high on her list, is also believing they're partners with providers. And I agree with you, Scott. Providers don't always see it that way. As a kind of lawyer now, I'm not sure I always see it that way with certain rules that come out. But that's how the agency views it. What I would say, however, and I think this is why sometimes the agency comes in for kind of negative views, you know, it's very policy centric. You said bureaucratic. I probably wouldn't disagree with that characterization, but a view of the world that if we say X, X will happen, Scott. And I think that leads to, you know, differences with how providers view it. I think it can also, and I'd be happy to share stories with your listeners, but it leads to a situation where, you know, the rulemaking or the reimbursement rate or kind of how they view it in Baltimore or in DC itself doesn't always meet the reality in Peoria or where, you know, patients are actually being served.
You know, and a fascinating thought. Let me ask you one other question. In rural health, what is yes. this? The rural health has already been hugely disrupted pre-COVID-19 because there's just not enough doctors, providers, systems to serve smaller communities in our country, and there's not the economics to do so. There's all kinds of reasons why more and more has moved towards regional and centralized places, while still having primary care in a lot of communities. Will COVID-19 further blow up rural healthcare, or will it lead to a rethinking of it? Any initial perspectives on that? I know it's a very tough question.
You know, I mean, my hope, and I think it's your hope as well, Scott, is it's a rethinking and it's a redoubling down on support. And I worked with amazing doctors and administrators at my time at the Rural Health Association, just immense dedication to their communities, you know, kind of above and beyond the call of medicine to, you know, being the engine, economic engine in their community. I think your point's right on the mark. The concern is, you know, HHS put out $10 billion of provider payments to rural healthcare providers. You know, I applaud them. It was absolutely needed. But that's just a drop in a bucket for providers who were already struggling with the changes to outpatient care, the changes in reimbursement, the flat payments on Medicare. To see just a small grant right now is not going to cure the problem when these rural communities' hospitals maybe haven't seen as many COVID patients, but they've shut down their elective procedures just the same. And so, you know, whether it's, you know, everyone wants telehealth, everyone wants things like accountable care organizations and networks, are those the solution in rural communities? I don't know, Scott, but I certainly think there are people smarter than I thinking about that. And hopefully this crisis can be kind of a opportunity for them to continue to be heard and get the financial, institutional, and regulatory support to kind of make changes in the post-COVID world. So I know that's not exactly on point, but, you know, hopefully there are some initiatives that come out of this that can be applied in the long term.
Thank you very much. Tim, you're one of the most compassionate and intelligent lawyers I've ever had a chance to work with. When you say things like, there's people smarter than me that will decide on those issues or think about those issues, I think that's false modesty because you're actually one of the brightest people that I know as well. I want to thank you, Tim Fry, for joining us today. I know you could be reached at Tim Fry at McGuire Woods or T. Fry at McGuire Woods or at the McGuire Woods Law Firm, but you're just a magnificent lawyer and person, and it's a pleasure to talk to you today.
Scott, I can't thank you enough. An honor to be with you, and if I can be helpful to any of your listeners, please don't hesitate to reach out.